This is the Pacifica National Board meeting, February 22nd, 2013, reconvening in open session at 4:13 p.m. Eastern, 1:13 p.m. Pacific, Summary's Chair, and we are back in open. Thank you, everybody, for rejoining us. The matter on the floor before we adjourn to closed session is still on the floor, which was the motion from Member Medina challenging the seating of the elected members of WPFW. And if you'd like to, do you want to reiterate your wording, or shall I recap for you? Okay. So essentially, Brenda Medina's motion is that those candidates who were nominated by the December 31st deadline in the bylaws are the properly nominated WPFW representatives and should be seated instead of the members that were elected in the subsequent WPFW PNB directors election. If you support that motion, then vote yes. If you do not, then vote no, or you may abstain. There's no need for further discussion. We've been on this for the last couple of hours, and we have done closed session for discussion with counsel. I would respectfully ask again that the WPFW members currently sitting at the table please recuse themselves from the vote as it impacts upon them. And everyone else, we may take the vote. I will go ahead and call the roll now. Brian Edwards Tiekert.
Yes.
Tracy Rosenberg.
No.
Dan Siegel is absent. Margie Wilkinson.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Skipping PFW. Lydia Brazone.
Yes.
John Crumshaw.
No.
Brenda Medina.
Yes.
Heather Gray.
No.
Janice Lane Ewart.
No.
Teresa Allen.
No.
Jessica Apollinar.
No.
Nancy Henschel.
Stay.
Richard Uzel.
No.
Carolyn Burden.
No.
Janet Coleman.
No.
Serene Roberts.
Yes.
Manajé Saba.
No.
And I had one pass. Did I not?
Yes.
I'm sorry, who was the pass? Oh, thank you. You're going to abstain. Okay. Is there anyone I did not call upon?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And
okay, so it's 5 yes, 10 no, 2 abstentions. The currently seated board members shall remain seated. Thank you all for your time. So this board is now after, 7.5 hours, almost 7.25 hours, is now a composed PNB board. Thank you. Welcome all to the new 2013 PNB. Our first accomplishment of the day. Okay, so thank you. And several hours off schedule, but we'll survive. I have Member Rosenberg raising her hand. Welcome.
I realize this suggestion might incite some violence, and I am willing to bag the issue for now. However, I did put forward a motion that I hope is uncontroversial regarding referring the bylaws provisions language regarding an eligibility to be a delegate due to public officer position clause to the PNB Governance Committee, asking for a recommendation.
No, I seconded that.
For how to clarify that, so I believe it would be on the floor, and if we could bring it to a vote quickly and without excessive controversy, that would be my preference.
Okay,
thank you. If it is not the case, I am willing to
put it aside,
re-enter it at some other point.
Okay, so it's a referral motion, that's all, to clarify that portion of the bylaws for future reference, and I see a couple of hands. I had Margie and then Luzette.
Just technically, I think we need to follow the agenda, which the next thing it would have us do is designate a timekeeper, then elect pro tem officers, and then I think Tracy's motion
would
be
in. Okay, I can accept that as reasonable, Margie. We're so far off agenda, it's hard to keep track of where we should have been at 9 a.m. Okay, designate timekeeper I find almost pointless. Even when I do designate them, we just fly right past that.
Designate me.
Would you like to be the timekeeper,
talking, yes.
Margie? Okay.
But then we have to set time limits.
Okay, I will take a timekeeper. Thank you, Margie, for volunteering. Usually you have to draft people, so when I have a volunteer,
no,
that's good. All right, elect pro tem officers. How long do we want to take on this? Go for it. We should be doing the real thing by tomorrow, but...
5 minutes.
Thank you.
Are we accepting nominations?
Sure. The nominations are open.
I nominate Summer Reese as pro tem chair.
Thank you. Second from Apollinar. Nomination from Rosenberg. Ms. Brazone?
I nominate Margie Wilkinson for vice chair.
Okay, let's just finish off with one at a time. Is there, are there any objections, any other nominations for chair pro tem?
I'm sorry, what's
just chair pro tem.
Just summer.
Are we good?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, next. Go ahead, Billy. Nominate for vice chair.
So I nominate Margie Wilkinson for vice chair.
And is there a second?
I second.
Okay, second from Medina, nomination from Brazone. Okay, Mr. Crumshaw.
I nominate Tracy Rosenberg for vice chair.
Second. Is,
and there's a, okay, that was a nomination from Crumshaw, second from Coleman. Are there any other nominations for vice chair? Hearing none. Do you all wish to say anything before we vote? I mean, we're talking pro tem here, but it's cool. Like a minute?
We can say something.
Go ahead. So, Ms. Wilkinson and then Ms. Rosenberg.
You know, in the event that the chair has to step out of the room, deal with other issues, or be absent from a discussion, I'd be happy to be the chair, however much time that takes in this meeting. I think I'm a pretty good chair, and I try to keep things moving along, and I'm very fair.
Thank you. Ms. Rosenberg.
Oops, you just became...
This would be PMB Unplugged,
yeah,
the special event.
We should just keep this off. I'm not sure of the efficacy of pro tem vice chair, since I believe we'll elect officers tomorrow anyway, and we will meet for approximately an hour prior to doing that. If Summer is hit by a bus
God forbid.
The next hour, I would be more than pleased to temporarily take over. I think the odds are low.
I'm going to stay indoors now.
Well, if a chandelier should land upon your head, what I will say in my own defense is I'm beginning my fourth year on the PNB. I think I have a fairly good understanding of our processes and procedures at this point in time, such as they are. And... have successfully chaired the National Finance Committee for 2 years and believe that I would do a good job.
Thank you. And no chandeliers, no buses. I'm going to be just fine, but every now and then I may need to use the ladies' room. Janice.
I'm wondering if I'm looking at the same materials. Did we just stop to have comments from the two candidates for vice chair because we are then going to move to the pro tem for secretary?
Yes.
Because there are two candidates for vice chair,
yes.
Just because, yeah, there's
okay.
So they can each say
so
something.
So want to understand
yes,
the order.
Ma'am.
Thank
yes,
you.
Ma'am. Yes. Okay, so God, we got to do ballots for this?
Point of order.
Holy cow.
Point of order.
Yes.
If no one objects, we can do it simply with a show of hands.
No, because the show of hands doesn't show on the stream. That's the problem.
Oh, all right. Then we need little pieces of paper.
Gosh, help us. Okay, so as Ms. Allen graciously passes out ballots, please mark your first choice candidate with a 1, your second one with a 2, or only put down one name. Yes.
Oh, point of information. If, in fact, there are more than one nominations for secretary that would also require a ballot, could we continue with the process?
That's exactly what I was going to suggest, actually. I was going to say, while Ms. Allen passes out the ballots for the vice chair, we will go ahead and take the nominations for the secretary so we can just keep it moving. Ms. Rosenberg, we are on the same page.
I nominate Richard Uzel as secretary, pro tem secretary.
Is there a second? Okay, second from King. Thank you. All right, and Brenda Medina?
I nominate John Gary to be...
He's not a member of the board.
Not here.
That's not proper. That's the LSB, which is a committee. It doesn't apply to the PNB. It's not... I'm not even going to entertain that.
Okay, well, I mean, I was not going to nominate John Gary because he's not here.
He's also not a PNB member, so he can't be an officer of the PNB.
No, that's not true. Please reread your bylaws. It says you can...
LSB. But anyway.
PNB. But anyway, PNB. Summer, I looked it up. But anyway, I would nominate Teresa Allen.
She won't accept.
See how these nominations come sometimes? All right. Are there any other nominations for secretary? Maybe we only have to do one election.
By acclamation.
Okay. I'm hearing no other nominations for secretary. So a little out of order. That is closed, as there is only one candidate for secretary pro tem. Thank you, Richard, for taking on the responsibility. And now the ballots for vice chair pro tem will be handed out.
Point of information, do you want me to number these or put
A, B, C, D on the back?
No. There are only two candidates, so you may, if you choose, you can just write down the one person that you would prefer. You don't have to do a numbering system when there are only two candidates, unless you decide to put both people's names down.
By the way, contrary to popular opinion, my name is spelled M-A-R-G-Y, not I-E.
Thank you. And it's pronounced Margie, not Margie.
Right. And an R.
No, we've already done secretary. It's vice chair. Yes, secretary, there's only one nomination.
All right, I'm starting with Y.
I thought about it, but we went into it kind of fast.
Okay.
No, Teresa. Yes. Oh, you're showing your readiness.
Yes.
Okay. And
yes, sir. Thank you.
I'm rusty.
May I ask for a volunteer from the audience, or even to just so there's no question as to transparency in the counting of the ballots? Would anyone like to volunteer? Thank you. If you could accompany Ms. Allen in the collection of the ballots, and then we'll put them in one central location to be counted. Thank you.
No.
I tried to get the people who do the Oscars to do it, but they were busy.
Yes, I know. You bet we are. Thank you. My vote.
Yes, we'll be ready at 5. Thank you.
With extra words and more expense.
Parking are millions and millions and millions and billions.
So this is right here. With the exception of the chairperson of the board and vice chairperson of the board, no officer is required to make exceptions.
The treasurer is in fact in another party bylaws, but that's irrelevant.
With the exception of the chairperson of the board and the vice chairperson, no officer is required to be a director.
Why money?
It's there, I have it.
John.
Thank you.
John. What section is that?
So we have a
section.
I have a.
Hey, John. It's kind of irrelevant, but there is a clause in later in the bylaws that the treasurer also needs a director. It's in a different part. So for what it's worth. Yes, but it does state that the treasurer must be a director in another part of the bylaws.
Treasurer, are we talking about?
Yes, but it says that the treasurer must be a director in another.
Right. The officers. Right. The officers have to be necessary. Are the chair, vice chair,
where are my unbiased counters at? Oh, there they are. Good. There's a whole group of them. We shall know that the vice chair pro tem election has been done with integrity.
When the smoke goes out.
Ms. Medina.
I'd like to bring up the issue of secretary after the count. Okay.
Yes, ma'am, please. Yes, we need the numbers, please.
You need another chair?
Okay. 11 Tracy Rosenberg and 10 for Margie Wilkerson.
It can't be 10 and 11 because there are 21 members. Oh, I see, because I did vote. I voted for one. Sorry, I'm so used to not voting. I'm thinking, how could that be? Okay, that sounds right. So it's 11-10, is that correct? Okay. Thank you. And I guess I have to take custody of those. Somebody has to take custody of them. I mean, till tomorrow morning. Congratulations, Tracy. You're the vice chair pro tem. I'll try to avoid chandeliers and buses. All right, folks. Let's see. Oh, my gosh. Open session agenda approval. Andy, how would you like to do... no. Okay. How do I put this? We're so far off schedule at this point that Friday open session agenda approval is a joke. It's 4:30, and we're going to go into closed session in an hour because I have a business representative who's flown across the country at their own expense that we must meet with in half an hour. I would suggest that we allow Andy to do his half hour of fiduciary responsibilities until we close, because wasting time on approving the agenda, which is completely a moot point at this point because all of it is going to have to happen tomorrow. Every other single thing on the agenda requires more time and would basically require tomorrow. Ms. Roberts.
I would just request that we reconfirm or confirm public comment now.
There's no additional time for public comment
for tomorrow.
Oh, now. Time. Thank you, Serene. Sure. And what did Bill did this for me? Let's see. Right now it's time certain for 2 p.m. following lunch. So we'd have an hour public comment at that time. Okay? So, yes, Manijé? The microphone, please.
Is it possible?
Gentle people, we cannot hear each other. Thank you.
Is it possible that we compensate with all the time that we spend and we didn't get to what the agenda was today, was that sometime tonight we come back and do the rest of and not postpone it for tomorrow, because tomorrow we are going to have the same situation.
We're already scheduled for reception this evening here with a showing of Bob Fassel.
After reception?
No, it's not possible. People are too exhausted by 9, 10 o'clock at night to go until 12 or 1 in the morning. No, what's going to end up happening is everything that was actually scheduled for this afternoon will have to be dealt with in the morning tomorrow. It's not realistic. People have trouble making it on time in the morning because they're up so late, and it'll probably be, we're only... No, ma'am. No. We have half an hour left in open session. I was suggesting to the body that agenda approval is somewhat moot at this point when there's so little open time, and that we allow Andy to give his presentation on fiduciary responsibilities. But it's
Madam
just a
Chair.
Suggestion.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move, in fact, that we set public comment as a special order for 2 p.m. tomorrow and charge our chair with presenting a revised agenda at the beginning of tomorrow's meeting for approval.
Duly accepted. I will take that duty on. Yes, indeed. Okay. Thank you. And we'll keep the fixed time for public comment, and I will work everything else around that for tomorrow and try to make the most efficient use of our time so that we get through some of the unfinished business. Is there any objection to allowing Andy to present for half an hour on fiduciary responsibilities? I think it's a nice use of the time before we have to go back into closed for an hour. Is that all right? Okay, thanks. Andy. Oh, I have all of his materials. Okay. Let's see. Is this all she sent me? She stapled them together. Okay. I can take them apart. Oh, dear God. Okay. So, folks, our office staff, when putting together the P&B materials, in addition to putting something in your board books that should not be in there, which I'll address in closed session, so please hang on to your board books. They are for your use only. The materials from our general counsel were stapled together, including both the summary of pending litigation and his fiduciary responsibilities. So you're getting something that's appropriate for open session, but you're also getting something that's appropriate for closed. So, again, please hang on to this. We'll pass the materials out now. And how far in does the fiduciary part start? Okay, so the portion which deals with fiduciary responsibilities has a big page that says rules of the road. So just flip through, you'll get past litigation, you'll get to rules of the road, but please hang on to the package as it contains confidential information as well, okay? Thank you.
It's in here. Do you have one of the board binders?
It's okay. I mean, they get confidential stuff all weekend. Please just, you know, don't give it to other people. I'm going to let Andy start, and I'm going to hand these out to you, okay?
What tab is it under, Summer?
I'm sorry?
Which tab in the binder?
No. I'm about to hand them to you, okay?
Oh, okay.
I'm saying it's in this package was stapled together, and it should have been two separate documents from Andy. That's all.
Okay.
And it's about halfway through.
Madam Chair, I'd also like to remind everyone, don't leave it behind. Don't, you know, check your chair when you
leave. And, you know, frankly, same thing with your blue board books. I checked through them and saw that something was included in the package that, well, I would not have included if I had seen that that was occurring. So please hang on to them. I'll cover that when we get to closed session. Yeah.
Justice is blind. Summer, should I go ahead? Okay. Yeah, can you... I am being blinded a little bit. Okay. No, it was that. What you've been handed is... it's a couple of different things. Some of it is for tomorrow or for whenever we do the summary of pending litigations. That's the first few pages. You can ignore that for the moment. I do want to remind everybody, it's stamped all over the place, but it's confidential attorney-client privilege communication. So please don't share any of that material, and please, if you leave the room, be careful that it's not just left sitting out so that people that are not part of the board can read it. After the summary, which is about the first five or six pages, I've attached... just some material on sort of general board responsibilities. Last year, when I first came into this, Arlene Engelhardt, who was the executive director at the time, just asked if I could just, give a short presentation on sort of, generic principles of board responsibility. So this is not meant to be, a detailed presentation. You will not get college credit. There will not be a test. So it's just sort of a general overview. The materials that I did attach, because I think they could be some interesting reading. One is a chapter. It's called "How Charities Govern Them," or it's from a book called "How Charities Govern Themselves." The book is called "Rules of the Road." The chapter is "How Charities Govern Themselves." It's written by Betsy Adler. Betsy's actually recently retired, partner at a firm in San Francisco called Adler Colvin. Betsy, over the years, actually did a lot of our nonprofit work. Betsy's probably considered the dean of nonprofit law in California. So that's just something for, you know, for some general reading. We've also, I don't know if she's in a full retirement, but at least a quasi-retirement, but we do still look to her from time to time for general issues of nonprofit law. The other is a section of materials from the Center of Nonprofit Management. And really, it's an FAQ section. So if you want to go through, you know, it covers some sort of general issues, some of which are things that I've heard asked about before. There's tons of other reading material, obviously, on nonprofit boards and responsibilities. I don't know if others of you, you know, who of you have sat on other boards before, if you've been introduced to some of these concepts. I'm sure some of you have. I would hope that even on the LSBs, maybe some of these issues have been talked about, but I don't really know. As I'm sure it's no secret to anybody, Pacifica is an unusual board. Certainly from my experience, I've sat on a lot of boards. I've been lawyer to some boards. I won't go into that. But, you know, if you want to educate yourself in this, there's plenty of materials. But I generally divide the board role into two areas. One is legal duties, and the other is sort of organizational and operational responsibilities. As to legal duties, there are two primary duties under law. My work is in California law, but I think these general duties are applicable across the board, and this is a nonprofit. This is a California corporation. But there's what's considered a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. There's also, we talk a lot about a fiduciary duty. It's actually not technically considered one of the, you know, sort of formal duties, but it's sort of underlies really everything that we do. Under the duty of care, directors must act in good faith in what they believe to be the best interests of the organization, and act with such care as an ordinarily prudent person would use in similar circumstances. And I'm just going to sort of, you know, work my way through some of the basic concepts. If we want to talk about it more, we can. To satisfy these duties, directors are generally expected to attend meetings of the board and any committee they serve on, exercise their independent judgment, which means their judgment must be a personally informed one and not solely reliant on or dominated by the opinion of other directors or officers. Directors can rely on information and reports provided by officers or employees whom the director believes are reliable and competent in the matter presented, professionals or others retained by the organization as to matters that the director believes are within that person's area of expertise or competence, or a committee of the board as to matters within its jurisdiction if the director reasonably believes the committee merits confidence. Under the duty of loyalty, directors owe undivided allegiance to the organization's interest, which means they must not use their positions to further their own interests or those of another person or entity unconnected with the organization. The duty of loyalty also requires that directors always act to further the best interests of the organization as a whole, and not merely for the benefit of a particular constituency. The duty of loyalty is regarded as encompassing three related areas: conflicts of interest between directors and the interests of the organization, corporate opportunities that become available to the organization, and confidentiality of non-public information. A conflict of interest arises when a director has a direct or indirect interest in a transaction involving the organization. For example, Pacifica enters into a contract with an entity in which a director has a financial or ownership interest. This is permissible if the conflict is disclosed by the board member and the transaction is still approved by the board. Directors are prohibited from usurping opportunities and competing with the organization. The doctrine involves any situation where a director is presented with an opportunity which the director should know would be of interest to the organization. The director must disclose that opportunity to the board. If the board declines the opportunity, the director is free to act on it. For example, a director learns of an opportunity to acquire a radio station in another city. Good luck. The director must present that opportunity to Pacifica before he or she can pursue that opportunity on their own or with another group. And confidentiality. Directors are under a duty to treat as confidential the organization's internal activities and communications unless there has already been general public disclosure or the information is a matter of public record or knowledge. And again, this sort of brings back that, you know, the confidential materials that I've just distributed on pending litigations and other ways in which I will discuss ongoing litigation, as well as a lot of the communications that we've had in closed session. You all have a duty not to disclose those materials or the substance of any of our conversations concerning cases to any outside parties. And actually, I can expand on that one a little bit. You know, we talked a little bit before about sort of the nature and scope of the attorney-client privilege, which is something of great importance to me. Our communications, when I'm giving legal advice, are confidential. It's why we exclude from the room anybody that's not a member of the board when we have those. Any time that those communications spread outside of the scope of my client, which is the board, we run the risk of the waiver of attorney-client privilege, which, you know, just sounds like a bunch of words, but if there's litigation, and we have seen litigation in this organization before, the waiver of attorney-client privilege can be hugely damaging, because what it means is an opposing party in a litigation can discover the substance of my legal advice and our communications if there's been a waiver of that privilege. So, very important to me. You know, a couple of people have sort of, you know, talked about fiduciary duty, which is interestingly not identified as its sort of its own duty under California law. But fiduciary duty is a legal duty to act solely in another party's interests. Parties owing this duty are called fiduciaries. The individuals to whom they owe a duty are called principals. Fiduciaries may not profit from the relationship with their principals unless they have the principals' express informed consent. They also have a duty to avoid any conflicts of interest between themselves and their principals or between their principals and the fiduciary's other clients. A fiduciary duty is the strictest duty of care recognized by the U.S. legal system. Okay, and a fiduciary obligation arises and exists whenever the relationship between a client involves a special trust, confidence, and reliance on the fiduciary to exercise his discretion or expertise in acting for the client. The fiduciary must knowingly accept that trust and confidence to exercise his expertise and discretion to act on the client's behalf. When one person does agree to act for another in a fiduciary relationship, the law forbids the fiduciary from acting in any manner adverse or contrary to the interests of the client, or from acting for his own benefit in relation to the subject matter. The client is entitled to the best efforts of the fiduciary on his behalf, and the fiduciary must exercise all of the skill, care, and diligence at his disposal when acting on behalf of the client. A person acting in a fiduciary capacity is held to a high standard of honesty and full disclosure in regard to the client and must not obtain a personal benefit at the expense of the client. So that's sort of the nickel overview of duties. And also, you know, very briefly, I wanted to address one of the things that has come up a lot in my tenure, and will always come up, I think it has to because of the nature of this organization, is sort of the distinction between board responsibilities and management responsibilities. That's always an issue in every organization, profit or nonprofit, but I think especially so in a nonprofit, and especially so where there's a board that is as active in governments and management as this board is by design. So the issue is, what are the respective roles and duties of the board, and what are the roles and duties of the executive director and other management? Obviously, at least for the time being, that is further complicated by the fact that our interim executive director is also chair of the board, which is an unusual, it's not a prohibited circumstance, but it is an unusual circumstance. At the broadest level, and these are sort of general principles, The general maxim is that the board is boards make policy, management implements policy. But that's kind of useless on a practical level. The Center for Nonprofit Management materials that I passed out says, in response to the question, what are the respective roles of the boards of directors and management? It says, while individual organizations may define these roles differently, the most common separation of roles between board members and the management of an organization is as follows. Okay, board member responsibilities. The board of directors is responsible for governance and policy setting. This is a level of board oversight that focuses on mission, direction, priorities, and evaluation of the organization's programs. Other specific duties generally include financial oversight through the review of financial statements and setting of budgets, fundraising, and its own operations, nominations, election process, and board evaluation. A critical role of the board is to hire, set compensation for, evaluate, and fire, if necessary, executive director, and also CFO. Board members should not be involved in daily management. Should I repeat that one? With the benefit, you know, when I prepared these a year ago, it was sort of prospectively. Now that I have more experience with the organization, I see where some of the true sensitivities and are. So board members should not be involved in daily management. In most cases, they will not be close enough to the situation to have an appropriate approach, and this involvement can undermine the ability of the executive director to run the organization. The center, again, that's the Center for Nonprofit Management, has generally found that when board members intervene in ongoing management, there is not sufficient attention being paid to those duties which are the responsibility of the board of directors. And then executive director responsibilities. The executive director is responsible for day-to-day management of the organization and the implementation of the policies of the board of directors. These responsibilities include making policies operational through the development of procedures and rules, hiring and firing of staff, and specific allocation of resources within guidelines set by the board. While the executive director should have input into broad-level policy, this is the domain of the board of directors. At a practical level, the executive director runs the organization subject to the guidance and oversight of the board. The executive director doesn't make policy, and the board shouldn't micromanage the executive director or the staff. So that's the short version.
Thank you, Andy. We have a few minutes that we could take some limited questions, but we do need to go. Only my 15th apology to the public today, because we're going to go back into executive session for an hour before we come back for the reception this evening. But are there any questions relative to what Andy has just presented to the board that anyone would like to ask for further clarity on any specific issues? Lizette King, followed by Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and Benito Diaz, Serene Roberts, Janice Lane-Ewart. Go ahead, Ms. King.
I'm particularly interested in the point...
Into the mic, we can't hear
I'm
you.
I'm particularly interested in the point that Andy raised and he reiterated, where he talked about the members of the board should not be... Members of the board should not be involved in the day-to-day running. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you said that our chair as IED is not prohibited, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of double-edged because she is a member of the board, and at the same time, she is the manager of operations. In our sense, how do we?
I will say it's unusual. It's an unusual circumstance to have somebody sitting as both the board chair and the interim executive director. And I've said to Summer, and I'll say to everybody, you know, if she were to become full-time permanent executive director, my recommendation would be she could not simultaneously serve.
Mm-hmm.
And Summer has not disagreed with that. It is hard, quite frankly. I mean, there are some competing interests when one person, serves in both of those capacities. It's sort of up to Summer to differentiate for herself The ways in which she's acting as management and the ways in which she's acting as chair of the board.
By the way, I'm asking this on behalf of one of our delegation. I was interested too, but I thought I'll raise it.
Thank you. Andy and I have discussed this a few times. Ryan.
Can you explain the what protects individual board members from personal liability?
Yeah, and what strips it too.
Yeah, you know, and frankly, I should maybe prepare something separate on that. We can do that maybe on a phone call. There are sort of there's some things in the bylaws. There's some indemnity provisions in the bylaws, which you might want to familiarize yourself with. There are some provisions that if one is sued in one's individual capacity for actions they took on behalf of the organization, that the organization is obligated to defend and indemnify them. There is a director's officer's insurance policy, which has...
Is it current?
My understanding is, yes, it's current.
People keep asking this. It's been current since we got it. You're new. I'm not, but other people keep asking. Since we got it, it has continued in full effect.
Well, things are. Just wanted to check.
No, and you should, believe
insurance
me.
Insurance is good, and I would notify the board instantly if we had a sudden insurance.
As a board member, of course, you should want to know that. But yes, it did expire at one point. I think there was a very brief gap period, but there is a new policy in place. You know, there's also some general law that we could go into in more detail about the kinds of... you know, when you act, as a general matter, when you act in the scope and capacity on behalf of the organization, you should not be exposed to individual liability. You know, there are ways in which if you commit a tort in your individual capacity, it may not be covered by our policy. In other words, if you attack somebody in the audience that has nothing to do with your board with your board duties, that wouldn't be covered. But most of the things you do in the course and scope of your board responsibility falls within the insurance or the indemnity provision.
So can you explain it under Summers' framing? What things do create personal...
Microphone, please.
Can you explain it under Summers' framing? What things do create individual liability for board members? Aside from physically assaulting a member of the audience.
Other things that might be outside the scope of duties. Can you maybe elaborate a little?
I'm just trying to think. You know, anything. You know, there's certainly lots of things you can do that create individual liability. You could commit fraud. You could breach a contract. You can do lots of things. You know, just because you sit on this board doesn't mean or if you purported to enter into a contract on behalf of Pacifica without authorization from Pacifica to do that, and then tried to say, wait a minute, you know, I signed this as a director of Pacifica. And Pacifica would say, no, you didn't. You didn't have authorization to do that. Even though you were a board member and purporting to act as a member of Pacifica, you would not be covered under that kind of circumstance.
And if you'll indulge me, were Pacifica to cease to exist with debts outstanding, would those attach to the board members at the time?
You know what, and these are good questions, and questions I, you know, recognizing some of the financial difficulties are things that I probably should spend more time on, and maybe we can set aside some time for it. My understanding is that the corporate debts would not pass through to the individuals. Just as in a for-profit corporation, if the corporation goes into bankruptcy, if the corporation is properly constituted, followed proper corporate procedures and all of that, then the individuals are shielded from liability. You know, the same can happen here. On the other hand, even in for-profit corporations, if there's been malfeasance by individuals, then liability can pass through the corporation, or if they haven't abided by corporate formalities. We're pretty good, I think, at least at following corporate formalities and doing the things that should shield individuals from that kind of liability.
What about when the corporate status is suspended?
I know there's been some email on this, and I haven't really seen much of it yet. But my understanding is it was a brief suspension for a failure to go ahead if you have.
Sure, and I think it would be appropriate. Perhaps Andy and I will talk about preparing some material specifically on protection from liability and the things that would strip that protection. Predominantly, it has to do with unclean hands, latches, fraud, malfeasance, things where you're breaking the law. Things that would not be part of the scope of being a director. Errors and omissions insurance, or directors and officers, is intended to protect you from stupidity, from making mistakes, from doing things in the course of doing your duties, but because you didn't know you did something. It doesn't protect you from committing criminal acts, subverting the guidelines for being a director. There are certainly things that would take you outside of the scope and performance of your duties for which you would not be
covered by insurance. I've done a lot of reading on it, and I talked to the AG's office 3 times last year. I'm pretty up on this. So Andy and I will definitely, if that would be the desire of the board members, he can put together some materials. I'm happy to work with him on supplementing that. In terms of the corporate status, and I've sent a whole bunch of email out, but again, new board, not everybody got that. It went to the old board. The corporate status was, we received a notice of suspension on January, I believe it was the 7th. I'd have to go back and look at the email. We immediately took corrective action. We sent in the $25, the notice of reviver. Our office contacted the franchise tax board, discovered that 2 years worth of tax returns had not been filed. That's what they asked for. So we sent all of that in. I signed off on everything. We sent it in. It took them about 3 weeks to process. They take somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks to process anything that comes in. If you go on their website, they're processing December paperwork right now, so they're 2 months behind on what the public update is. On January 30th, they sent a notice, which we received on February 4th, I believe, and it said that, now that you've sent us all this other paperwork, it turns out that something called a Form 109, which is an attachment form for miscellaneous taxable income, had not been filed since 2006, so it was actually 7 years worth of back paperwork that they were seeking. And it's a form that whether or not you have taxable miscellaneous income has to be filled out and filed. You can put on there that, in fact, this miscellaneous income is not taxable, but they still need the form. Apparently, notices had been coming to the office for quite some time. We subsequently found notices with previous dates saying you need to file this paperwork, but nobody had ever filed that paperwork. As soon as we got that additional notice from FTB, we contacted them. They said they would take like the 2 most recent years to get us back reinstated while we track down the stuff that goes all the way back to 2006 just to complete their file. And our office contacted our auditors who did our tax returns for the last 2 years. They supplied the things immediately. I signed the tax returns. We sent them back up to them. And our other auditors were contacted to get back tax forms, and that was all sent beginning of February. We were told it would take 2 weeks to process. We're now at like week 3 right now. It's still not showing up as unsuspended on the website, and we're trying to see if we can get something sent to us. Since it takes them a long time to update their website, if we can get something internally that says, yes, you're good. But we've done everything from our office to comply. In terms of like how it appears legally, this was the failure to file one piece of paper, not a failure to file the tax returns or a failure to perform the audits. So in terms of overall compliance, we were compliant. There was this one document, and by now we have complied with all of that as well. So I think legally we would still be held to our contracts, obligated for our debts. I mean, our brief suspension is essentially it's a paperwork suspension for this one thing, and we immediately complied as soon as, under my administration. So I would suspect that, A, we will have the thing lifted and we'll see a record of that very shortly, and B, we fixed the entire problem that has gone back for, more than half a decade. So, I mean, that's, indicative of many of the types of issues at the national office, but that was the underlying basis to that corporate suspension was the Form 109 going back to 2006. Our insurance was not suspended or anything during this period.
And I'm glad we're on it. I guess my question is just kind of more generally a legal one. If the corporate status isn't in effect, does that take away the protections we have against specific as debt collectors coming after our bank accounts, personal bank accounts?
And also, I you keep going back to debt. Debt is never going to attach to the individual members, even if we were, God forbid, to go out of business tomorrow. We're not responsible for the corporate debt. We're only responsible for our own right actions or wrongdoing. Those are the things that can strip you of protection, your own personal wrongdoing. If you commit wrong legally, you may not be covered by insurance. But the debt wouldn't accrue to any of the individuals, regardless of what the corporation does, unless you went out and contracted for something on your own.
Your house is safe.
Okay, I had Serene and Janice, and then I'll come over to Tracy Rosenberg. I'm sorry, Benito also. So.
Okay.
No?
Yeah, we do have a question.
Did you have a question? Go ahead, please.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to wrap up in just a few minutes.
Thanks. Brian asked a question about liability, although I don't have anything for anybody to come after. But I was listening to a PNB call about 2 weeks ago, I think, and I heard a director ask for documentation of the coverage, and I heard you say that you were sending it out as you spoke. So I would ask that it be sent to the current PNB. And while the techs are in the room and before we go to closed session, if we can find out why those of us who are
on the PNB list, according to kpftx.org, are not getting mail from sent to PNB at pacifica.org. We didn't get a document that Tracy supposedly sent out to us 5 hours ago.
And I got it when she sent it, so it's a technical issue. So we'll resolve that
if we could have that resolved today.
Yes.
Okay. And if we could then get the documentation of the liability protection and all the documents related to the corporate status and the date it was filed and renewed and
And I could be off by a day or something. I mean, but I'll send you everything that was prepared by the office and sent to the old board. Okay.
If we could just have it in writing,
of course. No. And there was a written report prepared, so I'll just make sure it goes to the new board as well.
Great.
Are the directors required to sign an annual conflict of interest statement, and if so, when is it prepared? When is it forwarded to new board members? And if there is no conflict of interest, then how are we complying with the Charities Review Board?
What a great question. You have served on a board before, haven't you?
About 15.
I'm having confidentiality agreements sent from my office, so we'll have those in the morning, even though, as I said earlier, implicitly, you are all bound to confidentiality in closed session. I will review, and if we don't have a conflict of interest policy, we are an organization that does not have all of its policies in order. So I will check into that.
I can
now
send
that
you a sample in about 2 minutes if you like.
Fantastic.
Do
if we don't already have a pre-existing one, I'd be happy to approve it on the spot with the group in the morning. And I would like us to be tightly in order. When you go to like Charity Navigator, some of the things that cause us not to look so good are simply the lack of, say, posting things on the site or, you know, very small things that could be addressed. Thank you, Janice. That's a very good point. Benito and then Tracy.
I've been on the
Thank you. Please.
I've been on the PFW LSV for 3 years. And I've been lectured to by a distinguished person in the audience here who's a former director of the PMB for 3 years on the responsibilities and the fiduciary responsibilities of LSB members. And I'm using the LSB as an example because that's the one I know. But it's I can't think of the right word, but basically we are being told that our fiduciary responsibilities as delegates or directors in this case are somehow contrary, in other words, our fiduciary responsibilities to the quote-unquote corporation are contrary to our responsibilities to the people who elected us, be they the LSB or the listeners or programmers at the particular station. So I would like a little bit of guidance in terms of what is the basic responsibility of PMB directors vis-a-vis the folks that elected them, on the one hand, and the corporation on the other hand.
Well, you've stepped into what's one of the real kind of messes of the structure of this organization, which is that this sort of it's a political board. And you are all elected by constituencies. So in that way, you act as political representatives, which is certainly not like any board I've dealt with before. So you have constituencies like you would as a politician. But your duty is to Pacifica. Frankly, I think your legal duty, your duty of responsibility, your duty of care, your fiduciary duty is to the organization. You are elected, and I'm sure you have a fealty and a sense of responsibility to your constituency, but you have a legal duty to the foundation. If those come into conflict, that's something you just, you know, I can't tell you that. This is not a legal answer to that. It's just I can tell you where your legal duty lies.
Into the microphone. Go ahead. And then we need to wrap up. I'm going to take Tracy and Luzette, and then we're going to be done with this part.
Yeah, and I don't pretend for us to be able to finalize this issue tonight.
No.
But I'm just simply bringing it up, and maybe we can deal with it later. But
the problem I have in understanding has to do with, it would seem to me that if we are elected by people who are members of the corporation, then where is the distinction between the members and the quote-unquote corporation? You know.
Well, there isn't an answer. You know, there are going to be times where, pragmatically, there are going to be times where, you know, there, like in politics, your constituents may want to do something that you think is not actually beneficial to the corporation. You know, you have to make a decision between, you know, I think, you know, you're a board member. As a board member, I think your duty is to what you perceive to be the best interest of the of the foundation, not necessarily to the voting interests of a constituency. But those are, each one of those is a moral judgment call.
Thank you. Okay, Tracy Rosenberg and then Lizette King, and then we'll be wrapped up on this portion.
Yeah. Just a couple quick things. Andy, you had said something about the unusualness of the structure of a interim ED and a chair of the board being the same individual. And I think there's two things to just kind of put into the hopper about that. The first is, certainly within the context of Pacifica, it's not unusual. Within the past 10 years, we've had four different interim executive directors between EDs. Three of them have been the current chair of the board: Grace Aaron, Sherry Gendelman, Ambrose Lane. So it is in fact our customary procedure. The fourth time, it was our corporate counsel. I don't believe you're volunteering for that. And in fact, that was slightly more
unusual
and irregular than the alternative. The law on which this is based is not, in fact, in our bylaws, but it is in the California Corporations Code, which does, in fact, I don't want to say trump our bylaws, but is certainly the arena in which our bylaws are registered. And if people want to look it up, California Corporations Code 5213, Section A. I'll just read it real fast. It's short. A corporation shall have a chair of the board who may be given the title chair of the board, chairperson, chairman, or chairwoman of the board, or a president, or both, a secretary, a treasurer, or chief of financial officer, or both, and any other officers with any titles and duties as shall be stated in the bylaws or determined by the board and as may be necessary. The president, or if there is no president, the chair of the board is the general manager and chief executive officer of the corporation, unless otherwise provided in the articles or the bylaws. So that is, in fact, legally a statement of is. So, it's important to understand that, however unusual the structure may be, because you want to have the position of executive director filled, it is in fact 100% in compliance with the direct legal instructions.
Well, I'll tell you though.
Can I finish?
Oh, I didn't know you weren't done.
Yeah, it's okay. So I just wanted to put out that is in the code 5213A. The other point that I wanted to make is that there are several different statuses for a corporation. In addition to suspended, which is generally about things not being filed, that need to be filed, there is forfeited. Forfeited is what happens when you're told to file certain pieces of paper and you don't file them. So, in fact, the issues around lacking a corporate veil or insurance complications or some of the other entities in which you're not a functional corporation are really far more attached to forfeited status rather than suspended status. Suspended status is kind of the warning that if you don't do X, you are on your way to forfeited.
Yeah.
So it's important to understand that's kind of a halfway point. And it's important to deal with it, but it's not the same as forfeiting one's corporate status, which is the far more serious of the two conditions.
Thank you.
Okay, and I don't want to belabor this, but Tracy, I've looked at that section too, and it is my opinion that it does not. As I said, there is no prohibition against someone sitting as chair and as executive director. and we don't have to have a legal discussion about it. I have read it, I have analyzed it, I've even written about it, and it was my opinion that that section does not mandate the chair to become the interim executive director. But I'm comfortable with the situation, and I can send you what I've already written about it.
And I guess I would point out, in the for-profit world, it's not at all unusual to have a CEO who's also the chair of the board. You see that all the time in the news every day. It's less common in the non-profit world. So, Lizette?
And we don't have to labor this point either. I think we could come to it again, but I believe this is important. Based on the information we had from the PFW delegation, where the LSB has been denied information. This was done on the premise of proprietary, confidential information, and we were told it's proprietary or personnel. And at some point, we as a body, we need to establish that, because it goes down now to the other issue. How different is the fiduciary responsibility of us on the PNB, and when we're on the committee, because that's what an LSB is. It's a committee. We don't have to labor it now. It has to be a discussion, and I would really like that discussion to happen, because I don't know if I'm a committee member, what responsibility do I have, and what obligation do I have in terms of what information should come to me before it comes to you? Because what we've had over the last year, people who are on the PNB belong to that esteemed group, and we shouldn't know things, and it's a problem.
I think what Lizette is legitimately looking for is that the LSB, in order to perform its oversight function at the local level, do they have legitimate access to contractual information and other things which have, in this case, been kept from that local board based on confidentiality? And how are they to exercise their duties if they're not able to see what the business being conducted at their station is? And the PNB, composed of people from all five stations, frequently know more about what's going on at a local station than all of the people on the local board, except for the few that are on the PNB. Is that...
Precisely.
Okay. So
I don't speak English very well.
I know exactly the crux of the matter. So if you want to wrap on that, and we are a quarter after five, and we have someone waiting whom I told would be starting at five. So
yeah, no, I was going to say, I think let's say, can we say that as a separate conversation, Lizette?
Lizette, oh, we can follow up where he gets.
No, no, I did say that before. It's a big thing.
Yes, yeah. It is.
No,
a big thing.
No.
Okay, but I think it's a legitimate point of inquiry that we could use legal guidance on that would be helpful to the local boards. Lydia, do you want to be the last question, real quick?
I'm sorry. To make a comment. And in the past, again, when I was previously on the board, is that the PMB would decide together what it could communicate on confidential issues that pertain to a particular station. So, you know, just like you do the report out, you agree on the report out, except that you would do a report that the LSB could consider also an executive session, but it would be within the context of agreement by the PMB and its language. So there are processes and precedents for that dissemination of information.
Thank you. And I think we're also talking about some stuff which arises at the local level, and does the local board get to see it before it becomes a PNB issue also? So, yes, Andy, we will want you to opine on this. Okay, thank you, everyone. Gentle listeners, here we go again. I know this has been a real shuffle today, but if we could clear the room again, this is proprietary information. It's confidential session. It was already scheduled before we took 7 hours today on other matters. And we will be coming back for this evening's reception. I would say 6:30, not 6, because we are behind.